And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Michael E. from San Diego.
Hi, I'm Michael. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Michael.
Start my timer here so I can keep track of how long I'm here. I'm Michael. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Michael.
First of all, thanks to Sam for being here, otherwise known as I Got a Story, Sam. Thanks for letting me be here. I appreciate the offer, the asking me to share, and to all of you for welcoming me to your group here at SoCal Speakers. I am not a circuit speaker, as you can probably already tell, so don't lower the bar a little bit before I get started. But I am somebody who is a true fanatic and a true lover of Alcoholics Anonymous. This program has saved my life. I'm going to start, I guess I'll tell you a little bit about what happened, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it was like now. So I grew up in a family that, you know, people talk about how alcoholism is hereditary. That's not my story. I grew up in a family that, yeah, I had an uncle that drank, but I saw him once or twice in my life. My parents, you know, they'd have a gin and tonic every couple of days, maybe, and usually leave half of it behind. Just wasn't their thing. They were just not drinkers. They got me involved in a church program. I went to a decent school. I was loved all my life. That was never part of the reason that at some point I decided to pick up and drink alcohol in the quantities that I did. Trying to think where I should really start on this whole thing. I remember my first drink. I shouldn't say that. I remember as a very young child having alcohol in the house. My grandma drank occasionally. When they came over for Christmas celebrations or something, grandma would have a drink. And I remember once in a while taking a little sip of that, and she thought it was so funny that the little boy was drinking and how cute that was, and she giggled. But honestly, she was, to be really specific, she was a step-grandma, not actually even part of our family, which she was truly in my heart, she was, but not by blood, and that's, so if we're talking about it being hereditary, that's not by any means the reason. She did like to drink. So I remember that part of growing up, but I don't remember having alcohol in the house a whole lot. There was a bar in the house, but I'll get to a little story about that. There was, the same bottles were in there from the day that I can remember all the way through my college years. Same booze in the cabinet the whole time. So that wasn't part of the story. That wasn't part of the upbringing. In high school, throughout those young years, I can look back at it now. I really didn't understand it at the time, but as I look back at it now, I think what was really going on inside me was that I was comparing my insides, the way I was feeling on the inside, to the way everybody else looked on the outside. And I can connect with that now, although I didn't at the time. But I had friends that were on the football team, and I was in the honors program. I had friends that were valedictorian, and I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, so there were a lot of entertainers, a lot of movie people in my life, and so what was going on inside never compared with any of that stuff that those people were doing and were exhibiting and showing and how great they looked. And I never felt that way on the inside. I was always the guy in the corner at the high school dance, too nervous to ask anybody to dance or anything like that. I just didn't really feel a part of. Somewhere along high school age, I started drinking, and I can't really identify when it went from, you know, very little to a lot, but I remember a high school event that I was going to. I used to hang out with some guys. We used to hang out in the cul-de-sac and just, you know, be guys. But I remember one day somebody saying, hey, I've got a six-pack of beer. Henry Weinhart's, for those of you who remember Henry Weinhart. I had the numbers on the bottles. And he said, I've got a whole six-pack of beer. And one of the first things I remember is, what are the rest of you guys going to drink? I mean, you've only got six beers. There's three of us. I don't understand how this is even going to work. But that was the kind of attitude that I had toward alcohol all along. It was when you had an opportunity to drink, you drank from start to finish, all the way through. No caps on the bottle. You unscrew the cap, throw it away. I'm not going to need that anymore because we're just drinking. That was the way I grew up, the way my drinking progressed through my high school years. I think part of my story needs to be that my family, when I was young, my parents were very hard workers, and they started a little business, but they by no means, we were, I wouldn't say poor, but we were by no means well off by any means. We were lower middle class, I guess I would say. And again, that was kind of one of these things that I was comparing myself with the people on the other people's outsides. It appeared that everybody had way more than me. Along about middle of high school, my parents, they had their company became pretty successful, and that sort of changed for me in my world, in that I didn't have to wear tough skins anymore. Now I got to wear Levi's, and I didn't have to have a Husky bike. I got to get a Schwinn. Those things like that started happening in my world, and to me that was a big deal. And that sort of started changing my attitude towards what I thought I deserved and how important I was and what was going on inside of me. I should probably pause here and explain that the rest of my story, I'm going to tell you the best way I remember it. I can tell you that this is the way I remember it standing here today as of this moment. If I tell you the story again 6 months from now, or I've told you the story in the past, it may be slightly different. It's not my intention. It's simply that this is what's coming out right now, and this is the best way I can describe and remember it. So anyway, my drinking progressed. I'm getting into college days now. My parents have decided that since I'm going to be at the university and I need a little bit of spending money, what we did was we bought a house together, and I used the rent from the other rooms to help pay my bills, my tuition and my spending money and all that. But what the other thing that did is that kind of put me in a feeling of power. I had roommates, I was the landlord, and I had people around me all the time. And as the time went on, we actually bought a second house across the street. And down here at San Diego State, there was a period there where I lived in one room and I had 10 rooms for rent. So it was 11 of us at any given time, and the party was on. I mean, we had a band that lived in the house and practiced in one of the rooms. We had a keg in the backyard almost all the time. There were just always people at the house day in, day on, nonstop. It was just a complete, continuous party. It stretched my college career longer than most college careers. I totaled out after, I had gone to several different colleges, but after landing at San Diego State, I actually did 11 years of college. Got my four-year degree. Pretty proud of that. But that just goes to show that my mind was not anywhere except in the partying situation. That's what my life was all about. It was to have fun. That's all that mattered. And that came at the expense, in hindsight, that came at the expense of anything else in my world. I just didn't care about anybody else's feelings or emotions or anything. If you drank like I did, great, come on over. If you didn't drink like I did, really not that interested in you. Sorry. But that's kind of the way I led my life for a long time. And it's continued to progress. It progressed all the way through college, and it just got more and more consistent, I guess, for lack of a better word. I was drinking day in, day out, nonstop, early morning. I was the guy that took a beer in the shower. I was the guy that opened the night owl at 6 a.m., knocked on the door before they were open. Had to have the drinks in the morning. After I finished college, and I was still in college, I started working in the construction industry, and I started working, it sort of evolved to where I was running projects. And I could easily, I'd get to the bar at 6, have a few drinks, see all my friends there, two of us, and the bartender, two guys and the bartender. And then I'd go off and start my projects, and I'd come back another couple hours later, and I'd drink the rest of the day. And that was pretty much my day, all day, every day. We had some times where we went out, St. Patrick's Day, I can remember a few of those, leaving the bar and going to another bar. But that's what it was all about, was drinking, drinking, drinking. a lot of other things involved in it as well. I'm not going to claim by any means that I'm only an alcoholic, but this is Alcoholics Anonymous, so I'm going to stick with that part of the program. So time goes on. My drinking continues, as I think Kathleen mentioned. It's a progressive disease that I have. It just continues to get more and more. I just want more and more all the time. And it's, like I say, drink by the side of the bed at night, wake up in the middle of the night, have a couple slugs, keep going. It was consistent. Let's see. My construction career is going on. I've started a little business. The big Northridge earthquake hits. I've been down here in San Diego going to college. I worked for this friend of mine, had a partner in the construction business, and the Northridge earthquake hits. I grew up in the Northridge area, so immediately, you know, curious about my family. My parents were still in the same house that I grew up in, so I kind of packed things up pretty quick and went up to Northridge to try and help out, to sort of see my family and that sort of thing. And that quickly became, my family had a pretty good reputation around the neighborhood, outside of me, so they knew my family, and they came to me and they said, look, if you're in the construction business, there's a lot of us that need our houses rebuilt. Can you help out? So I started a little construction company doing earthquake repair work. And after, my parents' house was very badly damaged. They had a wood-framed house, of course, like most of us do with stucco, and the chimney in the middle crumbled right down through the center of the house during that earthquake. And so I ended up sleeping on the rubble in their floor. They had rented a nice big motorhome that sat out front, and I ended up sleeping in the rubble in the bathroom. That was the only room that hadn't been completely destroyed. And I lived there for a couple of months while I started this company. And I had been sort of thinking it was just going to be a short-term kind of thing, but then it turned out that it was getting some tread, some action to it. So decided it was time to go rent a place to live. So I went off and found an apartment, met my lovely wife, Deborah, who's here with me tonight. She was the property manager, and so I met her in July of 1994. She met me in September of 1994. So there was this 3-month period that I did nothing but court her and follow her around, and I'm sure she could feel my eyes burning from across the courtyard. She was in her office. And so, yeah, she said, I got 3 apartments for rent right now. You can have the one by the pool with a nice view, or you can have the one that's got a great access to this parking lot, or you can have the one that's right below me. And I said, I'll take that one. And she said, it's a 2-bedroom, 2-bath, and I don't need 2 bedrooms, but I wanted to be. So anyway, that was the start of our relationship. But it turns out Deborah likes to drink like I do. And yes, I've asked her permission. She said I can bring this up. Deborah likes to drink like I do. So we made a great pair, and we were off and running. And boy, were we a pair. We went on for years like this. Let's just say there's nothing we haven't done. Been to a lot of fun places. We traveled together. We've done whatever your mind goes to, it's probably happened. And those were the days that life was... at the time felt really fun. But it kind of brings me to a point that sort of carries out the rest of my story, which is the idea of delusion. And the idea that by this point in my world, I was completely living a delusional life. Some people think of denial or versus delusion. In my mind, I think of denial as something that you kind of in the back of your mind, you know, is really not, you know, you can push it back there, but you really know the truth, right? Delusion, in my opinion, is you just... It's a whole other world. You have no comprehension of the truth. And that's how I was living my life. I was in this world of delusion that everything was okay around me, that everything was fun. I wasn't hurting anybody else. We weren't hurting anybody else. We were just having a good time. The rest of it didn't matter. And if you're in my way, you just don't understand. I'm not hurting you, so let me do what I do. And that was really my attitude for a lot of years. Continue to drink. Deborah starts to get this crazy, crazy idea that maybe we drink too much. And I don't know where that's coming from, don't get me wrong, but I'm starting to recognize that if she's seeing it, she's probably got a drinking problem. So So she and my family too. They did this little mini intervention thing where they all sat around the living room and talked to me about my drinking, and I couldn't understand what they were even discussing because it made no sense to me. I didn't have a problem. If you want to talk about somebody with a problem, go look around. There's other people in the room, other people in the world. You're talking to the wrong person. I just don't have a problem. They were watching me, though, and life continued on, and like we do, I started running into some serious problems. Somewhere along the line earlier in my career, I had gotten a DUI one day. But now here at in this period of time around 1995, I guess, I got a second and a third DUI. And it was starting to become apparent that maybe they were have something to this thing about drinking. But I still was not much of a believer that I needed any sort of help or to change my life in any way. There was a day, I'm trying to think if I left anything out here before I jump into this part. December 11th, 2004. December 10th. Deborah comes home one day and says, first of all, Deborah's been going to this Smart Recovery or Women in Sobriety, one of those things, and she was trying to quit drinking, and it made no sense to me, and why does she keep bugging me? Because she's the one with the problem. I know she should go get sober. I'll keep drinking. Anyway, she came home one day on December 10th, 2004, and said, we're going to treatment. And again, thank God you're going to treatment because you got a problem. She said, no, we're going to treatment. We're going to treatment tomorrow. And I was like, well, first of all, I can't do that. I got to do my taxes, and I got this important job that I got, and I got all these appointments that there's no way I can go to treatment. That's just out of the question, but you should definitely go. You should take care of that. Turns out our neighbor next door has been in the program and is pretty well known around town in the program. And he had been sort of talking to Deborah about this for a while. Son of a bitch. They had decided that, yes, we both needed to go to treatment. So that day, early in the morning, they took Deborah off to the McDonald's Center. And then they came back to get me later in the day and took me to Rancho Labrie. And I remember it was just ridiculous. I mean, this was going to be, I'll get through this. I'll go do my 30 days, 28 days, whatever it is, and then I'll show you it'll all be fine, and I'll come back out and be able to lead my life again. Well, that's actually kind of the way it went. My 30 days turned into 60 days, but all I really learned in my first treatment was how to fool people into thinking that I cared about being sober. And I got pretty good at that. And I came out of treatment, and people, especially my mom, was convinced that they were all screwed up, and Michael's got everything he's got going on, and he'll be fine. And Mom never quite understood. Lost my train of thought. Anyway, I did this 60 days at Rancho Labrie, got out. I was probably sober 24 hours, maybe, after I got out of there, started drinking again. Drank and drank and drank. Got another DUI. This was now. Went in December of 2004. Deborah hasn't had a drink since, by the way. I continued drinking. So now we're into like springtime. I've got another DUI. My dad finds out I've got another DUI. Of course, the real situation here, since Deborah got sober in one place and I wasn't able to get sober in the other place, it has to be that place. So let's send Michael where Deborah went. So I went through another round of treatment at the McDonald's Center, and I got a little more out of it, I got to tell you that. But I was by no means ready to be sober. And it became very apparent as soon as I got out once again. This time I might have stayed sober a couple of weeks, but it wasn't long at all before I was drinking again. At the McDonald's Center, though, one of the things that happened is they took us to a meeting, and one of the conditions was you certainly can't leave until you've got a sponsor and you've worked the first three steps and all this stuff. And got to get a sponsor? Wow. So anyway, they were taking us to speaker meetings, and a guy got up and spoke very much like I'm doing tonight, and he told his story. And something kind of clicked, and I started listening. Still didn't want to be sober, still didn't really have any interest in being sober, but something sort of clicked. And I asked him to be my sponsor, And we started working together, and I started going to meetings, and I'd take my water bottle with the peppermint schnapps in it. This one doesn't have, this is all water. That was my MO, was I'd sit in the back of the room and drink peppermint schnapps in a water bottle. I was fooling everybody. You guys didn't know. Not a chance. They just kept saying, keep coming back. Everybody kept saying, keep coming back. Anyway, this idea of willingness, this idea that maybe there is something going on with Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to see this light in all of your eyes. You guys laughed a lot, and you had fun, and you guys were able to, like, do stuff every day. Like, you made a plan in the morning, and then by the end of the day, you had done what you had planned to do. What? That wasn't my MO at all. I ran by the moment, by the minute, and if it wasn't something fun right now, I didn't do it. And yeah, I made great plans every morning. I made great plans all the time of where I'm going to go, what I'm going to do, who I'm going to see. If it wasn't in the night owl, I didn't see it. This door of willingness thing is starting to go on. There's this third tradition I started learning about. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Thank God it doesn't say it has to be my desire. Because I will tell you, I have, up until this point, I had never had a desire to stop drinking. It never even crossed my mind I should stop drinking. Again, I'm living in this delusion that nothing's going wrong in my life, that everything's okay, and stop bugging me because I'm not bothering you. Why would you bother me? Let me go hit the bar at 6 a.m. If they're not open, I'll knock louder. Because me and my buddy, we got drinking to do. And anyway, the life's going on. I start to get this, going to meetings. You people are telling me stuff that I'm starting to hear it. I'm starting to understand the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that door to willingness is finally starting to open. Takes me to along about September 1st of 2006, when my sponsor had, you know, he's explained, you've been kind of dragging on these first three steps. We really ought to, you know, finish up the first three steps so you can move on to number four. So let's sit down and do the third step prayer. And I remember getting down on our knees and doing this prayer. And at this time, by this point, the willingness was kind of starting to show up. And I kind of started to hear that if I really do these 12 steps, that maybe my life could change. And maybe I want it to change, really. Because it's not anymore about getting you guys off my back anymore. It's starting to be envious of the fact that you guys smile a lot. And you guys seem to be happy. And again, you do what you said you're going to do by the end of the day. And I got interested. And I started to get this feeling that doing these steps is going to make a difference. So I did the third step prayer. And I remember asking God to, you know, at this point to say, and I really said along with the regular third step prayer, something to the effect of, God, whatever it takes to help me stay sober, please, please help me stay sober. And I don't know what that is. I don't know what that looks like, but just help me stay sober. So remember I had a DUI. So I'm doing court appointed four. Thanks, I appreciate that. Yes, it was four. At this point, we had four DUIs. I appreciate you counting, some of which were up in the four digit. For those of you who do blood alcohol analysis, 0.40 was one of them, 0.39, they were up there. So, and even one of them I had at 0.39, I were two police officers there, and one of them was telling the other one, this guy's not drunk, you're wasting your time. And he finally did a breathalyzer and said, yeah, he is. Anyway, I'm sort of digressing here. It's I'm doing my community service, and I'm getting up and I should, and I'm going off having my little peppermint, because nobody can smell my peppermint schnapps, so I have a little peppermint schnapps before I go off to meet the sheriff and do picking up trash at the side of the road. And I've graduated now from the regular peppermint schnapps to what they call super schnapps, which is 110 or 120 proof. I can't even remember now. I'm drinking a pint, two pints of this stuff every day, sometimes more. I'm hiding it out in the garage because Deborah doesn't want it in the house anymore. God bless you, Deborah, for being in my life. So I'm hiding it. So anyway, this one morning I got up and I had about a pint of peppermint schnapps, the 110 proof kind, and I went off to do my community service. And on the way there, I'm realizing, you know, I'm really kind of hammered. I probably shouldn't go stand in front of the sheriff and do roll call. So I turned around and came home. Now, this had been a weekend. Oh, you know what I ought to explain, too? I had landed this job for who knows what reason, but I had landed this job that was like the job of my dreams. My career, it had a great opportunity, and so I was thrilled to be working in this project, in this company, in the construction business. It's retail construction now. I don't know anything about retail, but I do know construction. I'm really good at that part. So they said, I can teach you retail. I just want you here to do construction. So the job of my dreams. I had started in June. This is now September, and I'm doing my community service. I'm about to go up and do a big project at the Griffith Observatory, and I have all this material and tools in the back of my SUV, and I'm on my way back now at 7:05 in the morning on the 52 freeway, and I had a car accident. It was just me, fortunately, but the truck rolled 3, 4, 5 times. Nobody really knows how many. Crushed the top of the truck in. I had all this stuff in the back. Fortunately, all that stuff had been packed in there so tightly that it kept the top of the truck from completely collapsing. But I did break my neck. I had broke my 6th vertebrae, and they call it a burst fracture because it was shattered so badly that it comes out in little tiny bits of gravel, so to speak. So anyway, I remember a lot of miracles happened when this happened. So I was coming across the 52, truck rolls, and the next thing I kind of remember, I see boots outside, and it's a fireman or it's somebody. And there was another man there that was coming from the hospital, from Scripps Hospital. He worked in the emergency care ward, and he was able to call ahead and say, hey, here's what you got coming in. So they were ready for it. They were ready that day when I got there. Saved my life amongst about 1,000 other things that day. This fireman that had come from work and was on his way home and knew what to do. As the story goes, I wasn't completely coherent, but as the story goes, when they picked up my truck, it had that yellow blanket in it, you know, that they cover the dead bodies with. That had been pulled off and tracked. So apparently they thought I wasn't going to make it. On the police report, the incident report, where it says number of deceased, they had changed that from 1 to 0. You could see how it had been erased and scribbled out. So they were pretty sure I was gone that morning. But I went to the hospital. They put me in a halo. Spent about a month in intensive care, got pneumonia. All these things happened that were just all the things that I guess I kind of deserved at that point. In the hospital, my family's there. My wife, bless you again, is coming to see me every day. And I mean, before this, she was done with me, and had every right to be, because I just could not get sober for the life of me, and for a long time didn't want to, and she wanted me to. She wanted to have a life that was going to go on, and she had done everything to protect herself to the point of moving out and then having to come, you know, she loved me, I loved her, we wanted it to work, but she just could not see a way that my drinking was going to be involved in her life. And so she had to move out, and she had come back. But she was seeing me every day in the hospital. People were coming by to see me. My family was there. I remember hearing stories of my dad breaking down and crying. My dad is not a crying kind of guy. And he broke down and cried over this whole incident. And the other thing is my sponsor. I had mentioned my sponsor before. He came in and saw me. And, you know, you're not allowed to have – only family is allowed to be in the hospital. So – he told a little fib that he was my cousin, and he was able to come in and see me. And I remember him, one of the few visions that I do remember, Deborah was one of them, of course, but holding my hand and him saying, Michael, you're going to get through this. AA is going to be here for you, and you're going to be able to get sober, and you're going to, if you'll do what we do, and now that you want what we have, you can get through this with our help. And lo and behold, that's what happened. After my month in the hospital, I got home and I still had this big halo on there, passing a picture of it all around there. But I had this big, you can still see the little bumps in my forehead. But was wearing a halo and in traction in the living room. And lo and behold, these guys are coming to my house and bringing AA to my house. My sponsor had drummed up, you know, four or five guys, and they were coming by twice a week, having meetings in my living room. And I was out of it. I couldn't comprehend any of it. But they were there, and I do remember that. And I remember the hugs, and I remember the, hey, you're going to get through this. AA is here for you. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. My life started to change. That halo eventually came off. They had fired me from this great job. In fact, they barely really didn't. I hadn't even gotten through my probationary period, so it was very easy for them to just say, you know, we're just going to get somebody else for this position. And that crushed me. But I was starting to see the other side of it. AA was starting to develop in my world, in my life, in my head. Started to change my attitude. Started to change the way I think about things and the way I deal with the people around me. I was able to regain that job, as a matter of fact. They called me. It was as much luck as anything, you know, these little miracles that continue to happen in my world. I meant to mention, when I was in the hospital, this new procedure, when they did the surgery on my back, they had just gotten a brand new machine in at Scripps Hospital, and it had never been used before, and the surgeon was the only one that knew how to use this, and he had never even used it. And I was the first. Of course, they didn't tell me that until years later, but I was the first that they tried it on, and that's just another one of these miracles. So these things are happening in my life because, and I truly believe that it's because I simply said, God, I need your help. God, help me out here. And he first put me in a position that I couldn't move long enough that my brain could start to clear. Nobody was bringing me drinks when I was in traction. And so my brain is starting to heal now. It's been 30, 60, 90 days. And my brain is starting to clear up. I'm starting to recognize that I do have a future, that I do have a good life if I just choose to remain sober and start to do this work and follow these steps. So I started doing that. And I started doing those steps in the order that they're written up here, not in the order I wanted to do them, but because I was going to go in and rewrite the book, all these old slang terms and everything, it made no sense to me. I was going to rewrite the book. I was going to fix the program. I was going to be able to do all of these in a couple of, you know, half a day shouldn't be a problem for me. And so that's, you know, where the ego had taken me. But over time, that started to change. And I started to accept, I started to care about what's going on outside of my own little tiny little bubble, the world that I lived in that I thought was so safe, and that delusion that I've been speaking about started to disappear. I started to see things for what they really were, and I started to put my hand out and say hello to people, and I started to do service work. And I do service work. I consider service work to be one of the most important parts of this program. If you've never been somebody that's swept the floor or washed the coffee cups or did the taping, whatever it is, manage the phone list, whatever it is, take on a service commitment. It will change your world. And what it started to do for me was it started to make me show up to the meeting half an hour early. I had to be the coffee guy. So there I am half an hour before the meeting, and I'm making coffee. But what I'm also doing is I'm meeting people. And I'm meeting people, and I'm starting to care about those people. I'm starting to make friends. My whole world is starting to open up, and I'm starting to see that the more I give out, the more I give to other people, the more I get in return tenfold. And that's been true for me from the day of that car accident until as I stand here now. And I'm really fortunate, I'm really blessed to be able to do service work on a lot of different levels. You people asked me to be the chair of the San Diego Spring Roundup. Imagine that. That's a pretty big position for somebody that couldn't keep a bottle out of his face only 12 years earlier. I get to do some other service work too. I work at the North Shore Zolano Club. I work for a little group called Youth Assistance Coalition, and it's just an all-volunteer thing, and we just help kids off the street, and we just help kids that are runaway or homeless, and we show them a better life, a better place to be, and it's just so fulfilling. And what that's done for me is it's made me start to recognize how valuable life is in all of its glory. The pros and cons, yeah, there's still down days. Don't get me wrong. There's days that are tough. But as long as I have God on my side and the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can get through all that. And I can, and I'm blessed. I'm truly, truly blessed for all of it. Maybe about all I've got for today. I can only express, there's a little saying that I heard. I steal a lot of stuff that I say, but how alcohol gave me wings, but then took away the sky. And AA gave me everything I thought I needed, and then showed me that I don't need any of it. And that's really, really been true for me in this program. Alcohol at first made me that person that wasn't afraid to go ask that girl for a dance, wasn't afraid to get involved in things. But then my world closed down to where from hanging out in the cul-de-sac with the buddies having a beer to drinking at 6 a.m. at the night owl in the dark. It gave me wings, and it took away the sky. Then along came AA, and it showed me that I could have everything and have anything that I want, and I put my mind to that, and I got my great job back, and I got all this wonderful materialistic stuff. And then it showed me I don't need any of it. What I truly, truly need is you people, and what we all need together is each other. And having that ability to open our minds and our hearts to those around us and put our hand out and just tell each other we love each other, it's what it's all about. If you're not there yet, I sure hope you get what I've gotten from this program. Thank you for letting me share. I'm Mike Lyman, alcoholic.